The first case on our docket concerns the application for water rights on the upper Yampa Water Conservancy District, and we're ready to hear from the appellant.
Good morning, Justices. May it please the court, my name is David Halford. I'm from the law firm of Balcom and Green. We represent the Upper Yampa Water Conservancy District, the appellant in this case, the applicant in the water court below. With me is Scott Grosskopf from our firm. Our co-counsel on the brief, Mr. Robert Weiss, is also in attendance. We are here on an application by the district that the water court dismissed, an application for surface water rights. And in our view, the dismissal has two primary reasons to which the district objects and for which the district requests a remand to the water court. The first was the court's conclusion that the application filed by the district had improperly asserted a storage water right, that it had only asserted a direct flow water right. And that was the first limitation on the application. And then after trial, or the applicant's presentation at trial, mid-trial, the court dismissed the application on its finding that the district did not need an additional hydropower water right for its stagecoach reservoir operations. The district is a water conservancy district. I won't elaborate on that other than to note that you are aware we have statutory direction and authority to develop water supplies for present and future uses within the conservancy district, which is basically out and part of the county and part of Moffat County above Steamboat Springs. The nature of the application, it was filed in 2003, requesting a diversion from Morrison Creek, which is a tributary of the Yampa River. It's a major river flowing through Water Division 6.
As I understand, Mr. Halford, that stream comes in below the reservoir, is that right?
Yes, sir. It's the first major stream channel basin into the Yampa River below Stagecoach Reservoir Dam, about a mile downstream.
Okay, so Stagecoach sits south, when you come down Rabbit Ears Pass, just to the south, right, before you go into Steamboat?
Yes, sir.
Yeah. And it's basically used for what purposes now?
Well, it's currently used, well, there's a hydropower operation, certainly a recreational operation. There have been some not substantial releases for municipal or augmentation uses, but not substantial. It is essentially a reservoir that's contracted for future uses for industrial, augmentation, municipal, and irrigation purposes.
So this diversion would require a pump back up, in effect, into the top of the reservoir?
Into the, and I'll describe the physical setting, okay, if you wish.
Right.
I fully intend to do that, Mr. Justice. It is for a diversion from that tributary that enters the Yampa downstream. 50 CFS were claimed. For municipal and other uses, you know the panoply of uses that a district would claim, including hydropower. Stagecoach Reservoir is a decreed and existing facility on the Yampa Reservoir, as indicated by Justice Hobbs. It has 33,275 acre feet of capacity, and it's the major on-stream reservoir on the Yampa. Why did the district file this application? It was stipulated that the district has contracts for releases from Stagecoach Reservoir of 13,129 acre feet annually. That's the annual total potential release from that reservoir under all of its contracts. It decreed in a separate water court case a plan for augmentation, a so-called area-wide plan to supply or augment up to an additional 2,000 acre-feet of depletions. Those are not yet the subject of contracts, but they're a district plan for an additional use. The analysis that the district conducted of its firm annual yield of the reservoir indicated to it that it had, under its Yampa River rights that currently provide water at Yampa or at Stagecoach, 8,825 acre feet. So, in order to increase its firm annual yield, recognizing its potential obligation north of 13,000, it was looking for ways to increase that yield. Firm annual yield being, I think you've heard that before, it's the amount that could be reliably delivered through a hydrologic period of record. And the district in this case looked at 1988, when a gauge was established below Stagecoach Reservoir, through 2005, through the last major drought, in making that analysis.
Ms. Halford. I just ask you a question. I don't quite get it. When you say potential releases, is that because you have a contract for 7,000 acre feet, but it hasn't been called on, or what? I don't quite understand. What's the potential release?
Well, the total contracts are 13,129, including a 7,000 acre foot contract with Tri-State.
That those hasn't been used.
Those contractees have not called for all of their supplies as of the date of trial. The discussion then about how they would do this that Justice Hobbs was interested in was to add the new source, the Morrison Creek downstream source, by pumping or piping it by gravity through a low divide over to Little Morrison Creek, which is a tributary to Stagecoach Reservoir, and thereby deliver the water down that drainage into Stagecoach Reservoir to add an additional supply. The application is filed and noticed, claimed a water right named the Morrison Silver Creek Stagecoach Pipeline. The uses claimed were municipal and others, including delivery to Little Morrison Creek for storage in Stagecoach Reservoir and later release, including all uses associated with Stagecoach Reservoir's operation and for which water can be stored in and released from that reservoir. And then there was an identification of Stagecoach Reservoir in the application as the primary place of storage, and its legal description was stated. The opponents initially were local landowners. Ultimately, in the course of the proceedings, the State and Division Engineers became party's opponent, and they are the appellees here, those two groups. The Water Court entered, basically denied this application in two stages, first a limitation and then a final denial. In July of 2008, approximately, I think, 2 weeks before the trial, the court entered an order on a motion for a determination of question of law that had been filed by the opposers, and found that a direct flow water right cannot be stored as a matter of law, and that therefore the thrust of that was the district has only claimed 50 CFS as a direct flow right, no effective claim for a storage right, so the only way you can use this is by direct use. You cannot store it for later use. The trial was then proceeded, and the district did go to trial on in an attempt to show that it could still achieve benefits that it had sought, notwithstanding the limitation to direct use. Ultimately, in April of 2009, after the trial, the court ruled that because it has an existing hydropower right on the Yampa River, that it did not need another hydropower right to run through its Stagecoach Reservoir hydropower plant, and that the only use of effective use of the claimed direct flow right, as the court had limited, was for hydropower. So there was no need, and there was a dismissal. The district submits that the initial consideration for this court is whether the application effectively claimed a storage water right and noticed that claim to store in Stagecoach Reservoir. The Water Court did not make a finding on the failure of notice or premise its decision on a failure of inquiry notice. It ruled that as a matter of law, a direct flow right can't be stored. And that was the ruling. Notwithstanding that, we have argument on appeal on an issue the Water Court didn't decide, that there's a failure of notice in the application.
But what do you say about that point that the only direct flow use was the hydropower use, and it appears, although we haven't read the record entirely, of course, but it appears based on the representation in the briefs, that there's sufficient water for the, what is it, 100 CFS for the hydropower? What's the hydropower rate that's already in existence?
The hydropower plant is 110 CFS capacity, and the district has a Yampa River hydropower right that it has used for that purpose, Your Honor.
Right, okay, I understand that. So it appeared that additional source wasn't needed for that purpose, and in your briefing, you identify a bypass, and in Pagosa 2, we talked about the possibility of appropriating a bypass. But it would appear from that case and just traditional water law that you would have to identify that purpose in making the appropriation. Now, does the petition, the application in the court, the inquiry notice put anybody on notice that in effect it is a supplemental source for the bypass, the release, the downstream in-stream flow requirement?
I would say yes, Your Honor.
Okay. What language?
The claim was for all purposes for which the water may be stored in and released from Stagecoach Reservoir. The reservoir, when it was permitted, had imposed upon it a release, minimum release, and bypass requirement. A bypass during a certain period of time and a release during the low flow period.
Right, but a release would be from storage, right?
Right, and a bypass would be, yeah. But the effect of the hydropower operation has been and would be, you know, whatever water you run through that plant, Mr. Justice, that the hydropower output meets that release requirement.
Release from storage would be an acre foot,
right,
quantity that's stored under a claimed storage right to be able to release it in the low flow period. You just identified the release as being tied to the low flow period. It isn't a straight direct flow bypass under that description, is it?
No, Your Honor. But the application claimed hydropower, and the effect of the hydropower operation is to meet the minimum release or bypass requirements. As you know, only the Water Conservation Board can claim a release for environmental purposes in the river, which is what these were for. And
I don't understand that. In-stream flow is between two points on the river, whereas the Upper Gunnison case would indicate that there you had an enlargement, a second decree, a separate appropriation for storage and release down into the channel on the way to Blue Mesa Reservoir. Now, are you claiming that the application gave some sort of notice that this was a Taylor Park type release as occurred in that prior case?
No, not at all, Your Honor.
Okay.
All we're saying is the hydropower operation, previous and prospective, has had the effect of honoring the bypass and minimum release requirements imposed by federal agencies in order to have this dam constructed and operated. So those are met through a hydropower operation, which is a legitimate beneficial use of the Yampa River water right, and became the claimed use of the number of uses the district originally claimed. It could use this Morrison Creek water directly for hydropower and achieve that same.
Isn't the point, though, this is a new application for a diversion and use from a different tributary?
Right? Yes, sir.
Which would require, under the Cannon Will test, a showing that the water is needed and it can, and that facility necessary to turn it into the reservoir for whatever purposes claimed in the application can and will be constructed, right?
Yes, sir.
And that's the rest of the picture.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, so where is the district's proof of the need and the appropriation notice that puts other users on notice that the intent of this new source of appropriation? By the way, what date would it have? What date were you claiming?
This was a 2003 effective priority.
And when was, what's the date of the hydropower right?
Which one?
The one for the existing plant.
The existing plant, probably back in the 80s. I'm not I don't have that specifically in my mind, Your Honor. The existing hydropower right has existed and been absolute for many years.
But the appropriation you're claiming in this case is in the 2000s.
To 2003, post-drought. So the benefit, jumping to the benefit, you know, that jumps to the second argument, but just to forecast that, is that by using the Morrison Creek water for hydropower and the satisfaction of the minimum release requirements, you can store more Yampa River water. in the reservoir. And the need is what I identified initially. They have a contract amount that exceeds the firm annual yield. And so the district believed that it needed to increase its ability in the future to meet its contracted demand. This hydropower operation, use of a Morrison Creek supply at times as a replacement for passing the Yampa River water, would allow more storage of Yampa River water.
So it's an exchange or augmentation plan?
No.
Right? No?
It's not.
We are exchanging the Morrison Creek water for the Yampa water.
In a broad sense, in an operational sense. Back to the claim, I think, the district did clearly claim a storage right. And I've recited from the application, you can see in the documents that it claimed and gave notice it's going to put this water in Stagecoach Reservoir and use and release it for all the purposes that had been decreed. There was inquiry notice. This is not unlike the Thornton v. Bijou case, which is cited to you for all number of propositions from 1996, but which included a situation where Thornton was recognized a right to store on rights when it didn't even make a claim for storage in its application. But the court decided that the nature of the claim was such that there was inquiry notice of that. In this case, we said we were going to store it. We identified the reservoir. It was a known and findable structure. And so that's the notice argument. The related argument that's there is sort of collateral, is that this would violate the one fill rule. And we've briefed why that is not the case, and the fact that you can have more than one water right stored in a reservoir. The one fill rule attaches to a specific water right. One water right can only achieve a specific annual fill in a reservoir, but you can have different water rights for different purposes if you wish, or as a refill. The July 2008 order limited the district to proving direct use, as I've said. We went to trial on that theory, and on the theory I've talked with Justice Hobbs about.
Mr. Hoffman, I wonder if you could just complete. You gave us a rather detailed explanation of the initial claims, and then you began to characterize them. And I wonder if you could just succinctly say what your characterization of your claims were. I mean, you started by indicating that you believe you did claim a storage right, and I wonder if you could just complete that statement as to, legal terminology, what you think your claims actually were. Because there's some confusion about, it seems to me, whether you were claiming direct flow rights for the purposes of beneficial purpose of storage, or whether there were separate rights that were being claimed. So could you complete that characterization, please?
Yes, Mr. Justice. The claim was to divert 50 CFS on in priority basis from Morrison Creek for a number of purposes, municipal, industrial, commercial, et cetera, augmentation, and hydropower. And then there was a claim, and so that would be a claim that could have been used directly for those purposes if needed. But then there was a claim to use it by storage, and I would say storage is a method of using the water, not an end use in and of itself. The claim was that the water would also be delivered into Little Morrison Creek that runs into Stagecoach Reservoir and stored in that reservoir for the purposes that the reservoir already existed, municipal, et cetera. So there was, in our mind, a claim to use this water right in two ways, either as a direct flow right or by storing it in the reservoir.
You distinguished that from claiming a direct flow right with intentions to store it.
Well, that is different than cases where people have a decreed direct flow right, and then they store it without benefit of court decree. For example, that's where the you can't store direct flow rights originally came out of. That you have to go through and obtain a court approval, much like the city of Walsenburg did in the Ackerman v. Walsenburg case that we've cited to you. That you take a water right to court, and you can obtain the water court approval to either use it directly or to store it. The district, we believe, asked to do both of those things from the outset rather than through a change case.
Let me follow up on that, if I may, then. Do you think that the trial judge or the district judge mischaracterized your application, then, when he held that you were asking for both a storage and a direct flow right?
I think he mischaracterized it when he said that the application only claimed a direct flow right, and that therefore it couldn't be stored. In the totality of the application, it requested a right for to use the water directly and to use it by storing it. And so from that flawed conclusion that it was only a direct flow right, the black letter law logically flowed that would prohibit storage. And so we believe the initial error was in saying this is only a direct flow right. It was a claim for direct flow and storage.
He seems to say you can't decree a direct flow right for the beneficial use of storage. And if I'm tracking, I'm just reading right from his order, page 3. That's what he says. So if that seems to me to be exactly what you're asking for. So do you think he's mischaracterizing that, or am I misunderstanding what you're asking?
He's mischaracterizing in the sense that he has said you're only claiming a direct flow right. The application read liberally, claimed a right to use, claimed a direct flow right and a storage water right. That was the district's intent, and that is our construction of it. It is not a situation where we got a direct flow right and then we subsequently decide to use it. From the outset, the district announced its intention to store this water and to use it from storage.
Well, I have to go again back to Justice Erickson's 1992 decision in the Taylor Park refill rate, because it sounds like functionally what the district is now claiming, absent quantifying an acre foot amount that would be stored under a refill rate, that somehow the inquiry notice that you're characterizing includes unquantified quantity of water that's going to be stored during certain periods. Is that now what you're saying? Low flow periods, you would store a certain amount of quantity, or maybe you would use it for refill purposes after the first fill, and it's drained down in a particular year, and you want to refill. Now, those are all things that are perfectly justified, and you can use a direct flow right along with a storage right. It sounds to me what the water court respectfully was trying to get at is that there's no quantity claimed on the forms that have been used for a long time, even though they've been recently amended, to identify how many acre feet of water you're going to store under an appropriation that's subsequent to the original reservoir's appropriation date. So could you respond to that?
The court may or may not have had those thoughts. It was not expressed in the order. The court said, you've claimed a direct flow right, therefore no storage. It did not go to the notice issue, Your Honor. It said, as a matter of law, direct flow, no storage. It did not address the opposers have brought to this court the issue of inquiry notice. The water court did not address that. Stagecoach Reservoir is a known and definable structure, which identified in the application, anyone could have gone and found out that it exists, that it has a known size, and that it has existing rights. So we believe there was notice that the maximum potential is the size of the reservoir, but given its intended operation, it would go down from there. And those would have been matters adduced and presented at trial. In fact, they were in the sense of how does the use of the Morrison water for hydro power in partial substitution for Yampa River water affect the yield? And the uncontroverted evidence was, something in excess of 2,000 acre feet of increase in the firm annual yield, still shy of 13,000.
But the application was dismissed. Apparently, the court didn't believe that the need for that amount of water was shown. I mean, the district basically identified its municipal and other purposes. The district apparently, according to the opposition briefs, did not identify the actual need, the beneficial use for that water. Regardless of whether you could firm the yield, it would be, do we need that firm yield for our system legitimate needs? So would you respond to that reason for the dismissal?
Well, I think the thrust of the dismissal was the only use is for hydropower. You don't need another hydropower right if you need that, if you read the order as amended. The court amended its initial dismissal and clarified its intention. Specifically, you don't need this for hydropower from Stagecoach Reservoir. Now, there is argument that We didn't meet the Pagosa test. That we haven't shown, although it's in the record, the population projections and planning period were stipulated reasonable. The argument is about whether you need water to reasonably meet those needs. Right. And that's the question you're going
for. Yes.
We demonstrated the existing contract obligation of the district and the hydrologic inability of this reservoir to meet that need. So this is not, Pagosa is not one size fits all. We're in a situation where we have an existing contracted and augmentation need that was specifically defined, and an inability on the face of the hydrology from the Yampa River to fully meet those contracts down the road if required. And in that context, bringing water over from Morrison. And the use of the Morrison, and I'd like to save some time for rebuttal, if that's acceptable. But the thrust of the theory we went to trial on was you can use the Morrison water instead of some of the Yampa River water for hydropower. That has the incidental effect of meeting the minimum release requirements, although we're not trying to decree an in-stream benefit, but it has that permit benefit, and thereby achieve an increase in this reservoir's ability to store water and meet the existing contracted demands. And I don't believe that the amended order, which is perhaps not a model of clarity, but I don't believe the amended order extended to those contracts are not good. Those contracts are infirm. There's no finding that they are hollow contracts, sham contracts, contracts not to be honored. You'll hear that argument, and I'll try to respond to it, and I'd like to save the rest of my time to do that. But just to close, I'd like to say we believe there is a beneficial effect, a beneficial use, certainly for the existing contractors, in increasing the district's ability to deliver water from this reservoir. And unless you have further questions at this time, I'd like to save the rest of the time for a rebuttal statement.
Good morning. My name is Charles White. I represent the Appalese, Flying Diamond Resources, the Keene Family LLC, Kim Singleton, and James Larson. I'm going to divide my time this morning with Mr. Scott Steinbrecher, representing the State of Colorado agencies, who are also Appalese. This case presents two principal issues, both of which are fully addressed in and supported by the record. The first is whether the water judge's rulings on our Rule 56H motion were correct. And there were two of those rulings. We've talked about one, which was that the district only appropriated a direct flow right and not a storage right. The second, though, which really hasn't been talked about, is that the district's appropriation would circumvent the one filling rule. I will discuss those issues. I'll also argue that even if Judge O'Hara's rulings are held to be incorrect, there are alternate grounds on which the court's ruling can be affirmed. The second issue is whether the trial court's decision dismissing the application at mid-trial for failure to demonstrate need is supported by the evidence. I will address one aspect of that. Mr. Steinbrecher will address the remaining issues. Very briefly, the threshold issue, which Mr. Hoffer discussed, is apparent from Judge O'Hara's order and the application. It claimed only a direct flow water right, and it did claim storage as a use of that direct flow water right. Judge O'Hara relied on established case law, including the City of Thornton case, which clearly stated that the right to store water is not an incident of the right of direct use. The Thornton case articulates the rationale for requiring separate appropriations, that whether it's used for...
Before you get into that rationale, you agree with the water court's characterization of the claims, which disagrees with the characterization that we just heard. And I wonder if you could explain to me why it would be inappropriate to regard their claim liberally as claiming separately in the same case, both the direct flow right and the storage right?
Well, I think, Your Honor, the fundamental issue is that no volume was claimed for the storage right. The only way to measure the impact on the stream that was apparent from the application was a rate of flow. Storage rights, as has been expressed by this court in many cases in the commentary, are expressed in volumetric terms. The Taylor Park Reservoir case that the court mentioned, it did actually involve beneficial rates of flow that were released from Taylor Park Reservoir, but the storage right itself was decreed in volumetric terms based on an application that quantified a volume. This application did not do that. It was only a rate of flow, and that is really the key defining characteristic between the two types of rights.
And is that it? I mean, I appreciate the quantification issue with respect to the distinction between the two rights. But for a moment, that aside, or perhaps stated differently, had they included quantification as part of that claim, would that resolve the problem, or would there remain any continuing obstacle to viewing their claims as separately claiming in this same case those two direct flowing storage rights?
If I understand your question, Justice Martinez, had the application been structured exactly the same way that they had it added a volume of storage, would that have solved the problem?
Yes.
It would have solved several problems. It would have given a basis for application of the one fill rule. It would have at least given the district a colorable argument that it complied with the form for filing a storage right. It would have demonstrated an intent on the district's part to appropriate a storage right, which this did not. And it would have allowed the trial court to apply the Pagosa doctrine against the volumetric claim to see if the district really needed that water. But those hypothetical facts obviously aren't present in this case because the application
didn't
do that.
And what I'm trying to get at is, in your view, that's the pivotal problem here, is that by failing to quantify or to make the allegations of quantification as you've suggested, they are essentially conflating these two rights and thereby running into a number of obstacles, which are the reasons these rights are treated separately and established to begin with.
I agree with that, Your Honor, and it's not just my view. I think that was the water judge's view as well. And this contributed very much to his ruling that this application would contravene the one fill rule. And that was a Rule 56H motion, and that finding was based on the uncontradicted deposition testimony of Mr. Tom Sharp, who was the district's representative under Rule 30B6, where Mr. Sharp was describing the district's water rights in general, including this water right, and stated clearly that the district viewed these direct flow rights as advantageous because, in his words, they were not subject to volumetric limits and would not be subject to the one fill rule.
If you could just clarify one thing with the court's order to me, because the court a couple of times says, may circumvent or may violate the one flow rule. And then I think at one time it actually says, would violate. And at any rate, regardless of the particular language, what I'm curious about is whether you think the trial court was actually saying, finding a violation of that rule, or was it merely saying there's a possible violation of the rule, which I can't determine because of the failure with respect to quantification?
You're referring to language in the Rule 56H order, which I would agree is not a model of clarity. That section of the order begins with the general statement that a direct flow conditional water right used for the purpose of storage may violate the one fill rule.
So that's on page 3 of his order, if we're looking at the same thing.
But then if you look at page 4, where he's talking specifically about the facts of this case and referring to the testimony of Mr. Sharp, he says, the applicant here is not applying for a refill right, and he was characterizing that as one of the storage claims that might have been made, but rather apply for a direct flow right that circumvents the one fill rule. I read that as being a definite holding that on the facts of this case, these rights would violate the one fill rule. And I'd like to explain.
Coincidentally, then again, on page 5, he returns to the language may violate the one fill rule.
He does. And if I could rewrite his order, I would. But I think it's clear, given the evidence, which wasn't contradicted by the district.
Well, what confuses me then, I guess, maybe you can get right to it, is how do we know that it would definitely, I mean, this kind of seems to me like it may or may not violate the one fill rule, depending on quantification. Without that, how do you know whether it violates it?
I think, is the core issue for the one fill. The one fill rule has been around in Colorado since at least the Windsor case in 1908. And the purpose is to prevent an enlargement of storage rights to the detriment of other appropriators. The only way that that rule can be administered is based on a storage volume. Typically, that's done by describing the storage capacity of the reservoir in the application following the Water Court approved form. Here, although the reservoir was named, the capacity was not given. And significantly, the application also referred to a potential enlargement of Stagecoach Reservoir. That capacity was not only not given, but is not knowable, since there's not even a decree for it. So there's no way looking at the application that one could know what the volume would be or how to apply the one fill rule. In practice, that rule is used for several purposes.
I wasn't real clear in my question, because I understand what you're saying, and I understand the notion that it circumvents the one fill rule, that it may violate the one fill rule. What I don't understand is the notion that this is a factual finding, that it would in fact violate the one fill rule. Don't you need the quantification, the volume information, in order to make the factual finding that the one fill rule would be violated, not simply circumvented?
I actually look at it the other way, Your Honor, that if you don't have that volumetric quantification, it would violate the one fill rule. And here, there was no information given by the district that would even allow you to get to that factual determination. Not in the application, not in the proposed decree that it submitted to the court under Local Rule 2F, not at trial, not even in its offer of proof that it submitted at the end of the case in order to lay a foundation for appeal. There's no basis in the district's intent for a volume. There's a range of numbers in the engineering reports where the engineer was estimating the amount of water that might be diverted from Morrison Creek. It ranges from 3,500 acre feet in a dry year to 8,000 in an average year to in excess of 12,000 in a wet year. They never actually quantified what that would be. Had they done that, then there may have been a reason to inquire further into the one fill rule, but they didn't. And as this court held in the Buffalo Park versus Mountain Mutual decision, it is an applicant's responsibility to propose terms and conditions that can allow the decree to be administrable. That wasn't done here. And without that, I think Judge O'Hara's ruling as a matter of law was correct. And I think the definite statement in his order that based on Mr. Sharp's testimony, this would violate, circumvent the one fill rule.
Let me just ask you one more question that might help me to be sure that I think the difference between us is actually one of semantics in terms of what I'm trying to get at. But
I'm sorry.
Why don't you try to give me a distinct statement of what you understand the one fill rule to mean specifically?
The one fill rule, as it's traditionally applied, is that each appropriation for storage purposes will allow one filling of a definite volume of storage capacity. Typically, or historically, that was done in the case of a reservoir that was used for irrigation purposes. It could fill once in the season, and then it was done. Carryover storage from the prior season was charged against that one fill. Water that was bypassed from storage, if it could have been stored in priority, is charged against that one fill. You can appropriate a refill right, and that refill right will also be subject to the one fill rule, again, based on the volumetric claim that is made. If, for example, in this case, the district had claimed a refill, which is not clear whether it did or not, Stagecoach might have filled with some of the 82,000 acre feet of storage rights that it owns on the Yampa River. And this right then could have been used for a refill. And the one fill rule would apply there to allow one refill. Did that answer your question?
Yes. It's been enough time with it, and I'm trying to avoid reminding you that I was asking for something succinct, but
I'm sorry.
Forgive me. Please continue your argument.
But this is addressed in the North Sterling case recently by the court, right? The water year and the fill rule.
Justice Hobbs, the North Sterling case did involve the one fill rule. What it held was that the division engineer had the power to impose a fixed administrative date in order to implement the one fill rule. That was the narrow issue in that case.
But let's look at the proposal that's for which the appropriation is made here. Morrison Creek would flow into the Yampa above downstream senior water rights, correct? So when it's put into the reservoir,
with the exception of the in-stream flow right in the Yampa River,
I understand. But looking at the rest of the water rights that might be affected, the moment you take the direct diversion and instead of running it directly through the reservoir back into the river instead of down Morrison Creek, and you decide to, all right, this is the time we're going to store this direct flow right, there may or may not be actual injury to these downstream water rights, consumptive and non-consumptive. And I found it interesting that Mr. Holford characterized this for low water years. It's exactly in low water years, if you store a direct flow, that you're probably interrupting the quantity that would otherwise, the flow rate for the uses that would otherwise be in priority. Is that correct or not?
That is correct, Your Honor.
So you have to give, the follows from that, you need to give notice of when and how you're going to store this so that the opposers can figure out whether or not there's injury to their water rights, and the state engineer and division engineer can figure out whether or not this substitution, replacement, or whatever's going on here is properly protecting against material injury. Is that get to the essence of part of the problem, at least aside from whether the water is needed actually for the district's purposes?
It does. I think it also relates to the second issue, which I'll address now, which is the district's theory that it could divert Morrison Creek water only for direct flow hydropower purposes and then store additional Yampa River water under the senior Stagecoach water rights. In our view, that really is an exchange or augmentation plan. You're using the Morrison Creek water to meet the hydroelectric power demands and incidentally satisfy the bypass requirements and enlarge the use of the existing Yampa River rights. In addition to not stating the quantity of that Yampa River water that would be stored, the district gave no notice at all that this operation was ever intended. That wasn't part of the original application. This was an idea that the district's engineer came up with in 3 days after getting the water judge's Rule 56H order. It changed the theory of the case. It changed the mechanism for increasing the yield of Stagecoach Reservoir, but it relied on other water rights that weren't part of the case and as to which notice was never given in order to create that yield. We raised the issue that operation would cause injury to other water users, potentially, because it would allow water to be stored under a 1961 water right for Stagecoach Reservoir based on diversions from Morrison Creek under a 2003 priority. So there appeared to be a potential for injuring those intervening.
Well, there is a mechanism in the rules and the case law that would be an amended application, motion for amended application, and republication.
Absolutely.
Now, did the district ask for that?
It did not. The district's response to the argument of potential injury was that the court didn't have jurisdiction to consider that injury, which is interesting because our argument is that the court didn't have jurisdiction even to consider that manner of operation and base a decree on the yield that would result from those senior stagecoach reservoir water rights. Now, the water judge never had to address those issues because he dismissed the case at mid-trial based on his finding that there was no need shown for a direct flow water right. And that finding is supported by overwhelming evidence, which Mr. Steinbrecher will address. I'd like to talk briefly about the notice issue. Notice is not the only objection that we have to the form of the application. We think there was a failure of intent. We think it violates the one fill rule. It was inconsistent with the standard water court forms. It didn't provide a volume that could be used to apply the Pagosa doctrine. And yes, we raised before this court on the first time, for the first time, the jurisdictional issue of lack of notice. Obviously, the Thornton v. Bijou case is relevant to that issue. In that case, Thornton, in its application, did state that it was going to store the water, but as in this case, didn't state a volume. The issue before the court was, did that provide sufficient notice? A reading of that Thornton opinion, which is from 1996, makes it clear that the court was basing it on the specific facts before it. It went out of its way to note that the decision was based on the particular facts, that it was based on the enormous size and extensive amounts of water at issue in that case, and said specifically that the application was more general than would be permissible in most situations. This is a situation where it would have been easy to state the volume and to provide notice of the claim, but that wasn't done. It may be that our standards for inquiry notice have become stricter since 1996. I would point out that in addition to having new water court forms for storage rights, which require a statement of the volume claimed, the court has also approved a new Rule of Civil Procedure 90, which requires the water judge to evaluate compliance with the form based on an inquiry notice standard. If, in fact, this application were to satisfy the inquiry notice standard, not having complied with the form, not having stated the capacity of the reservoir or the volume claimed, then I think there'd be a question. Would anyone in the future need to follow the form? If it is about inquiry notice, I think the law is, in the case of a storage right, other than the exceptional circumstances, perhaps, as in Thornton, you need to state a volume of a claim in order for notice to be sufficient. Unless there are any more questions, I'm going to yield the podium to Mr. Steinbrecher. Thank you very much.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Scott Steinbrecher, Assistant Colorado Attorney General, here today representing the state engineer and the division engineer for Water Division 6, Aaron Light, who is here with me in the courtroom today. The engineer's concern in this case is that in order to get a new conditional water right, the district must prove that it needs more water. There's been a little discussion about the trial court's findings below, and the trial court found that the district does not need this new right for hydropower because the existing right provides all of the water that the power plant can handle. That finding is supported by substantial evidence in the record. There is no evidence in the record to support the district's argument and its brief that it needs this new right to produce more power. And there's nothing in the record to justify overturning the trial court's decision on that issue. Now, you've also heard some argument today about whether or not the trial court should have considered the incidental benefit of this new water right on the district's existing storage rights. And Mr. White has raised several legal arguments in his brief addressing why the court was correct in not considering that incidental benefit. The engineers have not taken a position on those legal issues. And what I'm here today to discuss is that even if the court disagrees with Mr. White's characterization of those legal issues, this court can still affirm the trial court's dismissal of the application because the district failed to show a need for this additional water and storage. And as you, I think, indicated, Justice Hobbs, the question is, where is the need for this water? And the district could have done this in one of two ways. It could have shown that it has an existing need for this water, or because it's a governmental water supply agency, it could have shown that it has a future need for this water. Now, it didn't try to prove that it has a future demand, and actually, in its reply brief, it argues that whether or not it has a future demand for this water is irrelevant because this water would be used to satisfy its existing demands. But as we pointed out in our brief, in this case, the district is judicially stopped from asserting that it has an existing demand for more storage water in Stagecoach Reservoir. Specifically, the district is stopped from arguing that this 7,000 acre foot contract that it has with Tri-State Generation represents an existing demand. Now, judicial estoppel requires three elements. First, that the later position is clearly inconsistent with a prior position. Second, that accepting this later position would create the perception that one of the courts was misled. And third, that if this later inconsistent position is adopted, it would result in unfair advantage to the party asserting that position. Now, in its previous case,
Mr. Steinberg.
Yes.
In another context, we have an opinion on judicial estoppel, which is very rigid. You know, that calls for an intent to defraud, as well as there's five elements of it. So I don't know how you fit that in real judicial estoppel.
Your Honor, I am basing this on the court's decision, the U.S. Supreme Court's decision in New Hampshire v. Maine.
Oh, it's a state doctrine. I don't want to argue with you. But do you have anything to say about that? Is there any intent here?
Your Honor, I think the intent was, in its previous case, to exclude this contract from its existing demand so that it could prove that it had enough water to meet its augmentation requirements. And had it not excluded this 7,000 acre foot contract from its existing demands, it couldn't have met its burden of proof in the augmentation plan case. It couldn't have obtained a decree in that case. And so to accept the position now that this contract does represent an existing demand would create the perception that one of those courts was misled. On the one hand, they have enough water to meet what they call their existing demands and augmentation requirements. And on the other hand, based on the same contracts, the same circumstances, and the same reservoir, they don't have enough water.
I don't want to move you too far away from your judicial estoppel, but given what you're saying there, is there a flavor here? Am I misunderstanding, or is the district arguing that its need is established as a result of having this water under contract? That's not only a necessary condition to avoid non-speculative use, but it's also a sufficient condition.
I think there is flavor to that argument. The testimony at trial, I think, established that there hasn't been a need for water under this contract. And Mr. Halford indicated in his argument today that they haven't called for water under this contract, but the district is relying on the paper contract there to say that it has a demand that it has to meet in order to justify this new conditional appropriation. And it took the position in another case that same contract didn't represent existing demand.
So whether they're stopped from asserting something different at this point, would you address the question? There seems to be agreement that currently they don't have a need for this, at least based what they've said elsewhere, other than the need to be able to satisfy their contracts should the contracts be necessary, should the people with whom they've contracted have a need. And are you arguing that's not a sufficient need? They haven't shown a current need by doing that? Or
We do make that argument. I think for the court's decision here today that this can be decided as a legal matter on the judicial estoppel issue. But we do make the point in our brief that that isn't sufficient in this case based on the facts in the record here and the testimony from Mr. Sharp that there's no planned project associated with the use of this water, that the contract itself is related to the real estate deal that involved the water rights and the land that underlie Stagecoach Reservoir.
Are they paid for? I mean, have they received income? So it's a legitimate contract?
They are paid for the contract, but as Mr. Hallford has said, that water hasn't been released under that contract. If there aren't any more questions on judicial estoppel, I think I'll conclude by saying that what I think is really going on in this case is best summarized by a statement in the district's opening brief, where it says that the court shouldn't substitute its judgment for the district's opinions regarding its need. However, this court has already decided nearly an identical issue in its recent decision in Pagosa 2, where the court said that water courts do not owe any deference to municipalities' opinions regarding their own needs. And in this case, the trial court found, based on the record, that the district does not need this new conditional water right to meet its hydropower demands or any other direct use. And as I've explained, the district did not show a future need to store more water in Stagecoach Reservoir. And as a matter of law, it is stopped from arguing that it has an existing need for more water from storage. And for those reasons, the engineers believe this court should affirm the trial court's dismissal of the application. Unless there are further questions, I will allow Mr. Hallford to continue on his rebuttal. Thank you.
Briefly, I will try to make some response to the major points. On the contract point, the court made no finding that the contracts are not legitimate. In fact, there's testimony cited to you in the briefs. The district receives in excess of $500,000, $500,000 a year in contract revenue. The estoppel argument, the district was forthcoming as to why it portrayed in its augmentation plan a hydrology that would allow it to achieve an augmentation pool under certain circumstances. And it admitted that in some scenario, it might have to short contracts. Doesn't want to do that, but it looked at that scenario in a way to be able to provide an augmentation benefit. At the same time, it is pursuing ways to avoid having to do that by increasing the firm annual yield of the reservoir. It would seem to be the highest prudence that the district is trying to meet the immediate needs that are developing for augmentation by providing that mechanism, as well as increasing its ability to meet all of the needs that are there and that are expected to be there for the augmentation pool. There's no estoppel here. There was a clear planning to, if necessary, short contracts, but hope not to do that because it could achieve firming. Do we have a need? That basically gets to whether the reservoir contracted for 13,000 and to be committed for another 2,000 for augmentation with an 8,000 or 9,000 acre foot firm annual yield should be improved, that the district decided that it should. There's no finding that the contracts are illegitimate or would not be met. The suggestion,
even if the contracts are legitimate, I wasn't challenging that, but I guess what I was trying to get at is, do you feel is there an obligation on your part to show your need, not only that you have this water under contract, but if it's water that has never been put to a beneficial use, do you have an obligation to make a showing that there is a likelihood that it will be put, that it will be needed to be put to a beneficial use?
Certainly. There's always an obligation to show need. We believe that the contracts and the obligations for the municipal entity, which, you know, the contracts are largely held for dry year purposes, that those are prima facie evidence of the need. The state's argument in its brief is essentially that you have to go behind every contract and drag every contractee to court and prove the legitimacy of their intention, notwithstanding their substantial annual payments. And that would be difficult. Think of how that would apply to municipalities across the state. There was no evidence that these contracts will not be called when needed.
I understand that, but I couldn't come right up with the figures now, not looking at the briefs and not having the record, but it seemed to me like, what is the Stagecoach reservoir capacity?
33,275.
Right, and then there was an assertion that there's much more water appropriated through the district's rights. The quantity 80,000 kind of sticks in my mind. So
there's a lot of paper water rights associated with Stagecoach Reservoir. Those rights do not, when you analyze them, produce the wet water to fill that reservoir and refill it and refill it. They produce less than is needed for the 13,000 of contracted demand.
So how much an acre feet is that difference?
To
make the firm fill, to firm up the supply. You need it, what is the acre foot amount you would need in addition to the 88,000?
Currently it's the spread between the 8,800 of firm annual yield of 9,000 and the 13,000 plus 2,015.
So what's the quantity?
15,000, about 6,000 acre feet. And this decree, if operated on hydropower, would achieve 2,000 plus. If operated on storage, 3,000. 3,500 plus. The operation intended by the district would not achieve the current obligations as first seen by the district, but would improve the situation. And I'm out of time, but thank you.
On behalf of the court, I thank all the council for your arguments. Case stands.